Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your temporary host, Alex. We all know the personal essay. You might have written one for college. Talked about how you went and worked at an orphanage somewhere and discovered that the real mystery was yourself all along. But beyond being a bad way to determine whether or not you deserve to go to our college, personal essays also make a great audio story. This week and next week, we'll be diving deep into some of our new reporters' lives via the personal essay. All that and more right now on Real College Podcast. We've all dreamed of being stand-up comedians. Even our host, Jacob, gave it a shot last year. But alas, not everyone is quite cut out to be a stand-up comedian. Austin Maclis tells us his story.
I had a short career performing stand-up comedy. Well, it wasn't much of a career, but it was short. Very, very short. I started stand-up my freshman year of college. At first, it seemed like the perfect fit for me. I like comedy, I like jokes, I like making people laugh, and I thought that I would really like stand-up. But there's just one little problem. I wasn't very good at it. Actually, I was bad. Really bad. That's why last year, less than 2 years after I started, I decided to quit stand-up for good. But not before putting myself through a lot of embarrassment. So I thought I'd revisit some of my worst experiences on stage. Not only for your amusement, but to understand exactly where I went wrong. When I came to college, I started performing every month at the Comedy Corner Underground. It's this little club in the basement of a bar on Seven Corners, near West Bank. The university's comedy club, which I was part of at the time, hosted a stand-up showcase the first Thursday of every month. I remember going with my good pal, Fletcher.
I remember, like, you had been pitching your jokes to me the entire walk over, the entire train ride over to the comedy club.
I'd practice a lot of my jokes too many times to count, but I was extremely nervous to get up and perform, and it clearly showed.
Well, a lot of your body language, you would hold on to the mic with two hands and have this odd nervous smile that you never really saw on your face in many other situations.
That's my good friend, Nathan. He's known me ever since elementary school, and he's seen a lot of my stand-up.
And you would pace around the stage like you had to pee, and you would talk extremely, extremely fast. You didn't seem to be too confident up there.
Even for him, someone who's rooting for me, it was hard to watch.
It was pretty cringeworthy, and, you know, when there was laughter, there wasn't a lot of it. It wasn't plentiful. And when there wasn't laughter, that was a lot of the time.
It was like every time I got up on stage, I somehow changed.
You're like normally a very outgoing person, and then you got up on stage, and you were just incredibly different. It was as if you, like if you're like a grape usually, you became a raisin on stage. It was so funny.
I was always very uncomfortable performing, so I tried practicing a lot, just trying to get comfortable with my jokes and moving around.
But you would run them by me 100 times. You would always sit down, you would sit me down and be like, Fletcher, can you just like hear my stand-up set for a second and then give me notes? And then you would go through like a third of it and go, damn it, that joke's stupid. That's not how it goes.
But I never really found my groove performing, and the audiences could sense it.
Your stage presence at a stand-up was always a little troubling. Our audiences did not tend to enjoy you.
That's Max, another friend of mine. And he happens to be the president of the university's comedy club. He's a well-known student comedian on campus who's very, very funny. I wanted Max's opinion on my humor. Maybe I'm just not a funny person.
Your stand-up was occasionally good. Your stand-up was occasionally like, oh, that's clever. Ooh, I like this idea. I genuinely do think you are funny as a person.
Or maybe my stand-up actually had some potential.
There were occasionally moments where it's like, I like this idea, and there were occasionally moments where it's like, I don't know where Austin's going with this idea.
Most of my jokes were focused sort of on niche ideas, weird thoughts, and a lot of political issues. They were kind of out there. But every once in a while, my set went over pretty well.
I think the jokes were good. I think the jokes were good in concept. I think the writing was fine. I just think you got too flustered or something.
I mean, there were moments where I'd laugh, but overall it struggled a bit.
At least for me, well-received jokes were few and far between. And the number of bad sets was a lot more. Despite this, I was still performing stand-up. I even signed up for the Funniest Person in the Twin Cities, a yearly stand-up contest run by Acme Comedy Club. Let me tell you, it did not go over well.
There was that one night specifically at Acme where I was just like curled up in a ball in my chair because it was just so, it was just such a bomb. It was so bad.
For about a month leading up to the contest, I practiced my jokes nearly every day. I'd written a brand new set, which I thought was actually pretty decent. And I decided to invite a lot of my friends.
And we went to go watch you with a couple friends.
The day of the show, I arrived early to Acme. Way too early. I sat in the green room waiting, slowly growing more and more anxious. Some of the other comedians started coming in, including Ronnie Chang, who's known for his work on The Daily Show. They made small talk as I paced around the room. By the time I was called on stage, I was terrified.
It was a pretty big crowd for a weekday, and I could tell that you were really nervous.
My hands were shaking, my throat was dry, but there was nothing I could do. So I cleared my throat and told my first joke to complete silence.
And we watched you get up on stage, and you did your 3 minutes, and it was just like crickets, like all just completely silent, total cringeworthy, and that was probably the most secondhand embarrassment I've gotten from a comedy show ever.
I bombed that night the hardest I've ever bombed. Maybe even the hardest anyone has ever bombed. I did so bad, it's become a bit of a legend in my friend group.
I wish I was there the night you bombed at Acme. I've heard that tale. I wish I was there, honestly.
But I did get to open for Ronnie Chang, and that was enough for me. Shortly thereafter, I decided to retire. To this day, when I ask Nathan, Fletcher, and Max how my stand-up was, this is their response.
Was I good or bad?
I mean, I guess you'd, on the good to bad spectrum, you'd fall more towards the bad range.
When I'd watch, the general vibe was silence, and so I'd just try to laugh a little extra hard because I would be trying to get things going.
You were bad.
That just about sums up my very short, very bad career as a comedian. For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Austin Magalus.
I've always dreamed of going to Paris, visiting the Louvre, walking by the Seine, buying a croissant from a man with a fantastically curvy mustache. Alas, I can but dream. Elizabeth Yost, on the other hand, is a lot braver than me and actually went to Paris last year. Lived there for a year. Elizabeth tells her story about living in Paris and her strange transition back to the States.
You've heard the story a thousand times. Neurotic American isn't sure of her path in life. She moves to Europe and finds herself. Truth is, as always, a little more complicated. After my senior year of high school, I decided I needed to do something other than school. High school was, well, how high school is for kids that like podcasts more than football games. It wasn't too bad, but my senior year was harder than it should have been, and I needed whatever was as different as possible from high school in Nebraska. So I did what, at the time, seemed like a natural progression. I searched for nannying jobs in France through what is basically online dating for childcare. As I tell the story now, it seems chaotic and maybe a little stupid, but I did my research, and within a couple of months, I was getting off a plane in Paris, officially moving to a country where I knew zero people. The beginning was shockingly lonely. As soon as I dropped my suitcase on the floor of my empty bedroom in the attic of my new house, I wanted to go home. I missed my dog, my own bed, and being in the same time zone as everyone I knew. I thought I was good at being on my own, but I'd never had to deal with this feeling of complete loneliness. It all got better, as most things do. I was really good at my job. I met amazing people. I ate a lot of delicious Parisian bread. I traveled and painted and practiced my French.
I don't want to be that one who, you know, says, ah oui, et quand j'habitais à Paris, c'était comme ça et comme ça.
This is my friend Lindsay. She was my best friend in Paris, and now we're distance friends in America. She is saying that she doesn't want to be the one romanticizing her time in Paris now that she's back in the States. But that's hard to do when so much of it was so good.
I expected it to feel this way, kind of like a dream. Paris was a dream. Not in, although also in the romantic sense, but not in the sense that like, oh, and I lived in Paris and everything was perfect, but you leave for a year and then you come back and it's just like time just pinches off. Like you're right back where you were a year ago, although everything's changed. And then you jump into new parts of life. I think it's impossible to go back to the same routine just because so much is different. You're different. The places that you're going and the things that you're doing are different.
This confusion about time and change and culture make it really difficult for Lindsay and me to fully express how our years in France were and what it's like to move back now. A lot of our conversation unintentionally avoided these topics, choosing instead to reflect on our favorite days in Paris.
I have a video from that day. It's just a little clip of you saying, with this excellent face, I have to eat all the pastries.
Oh, yeah, because it was getting close to the time when we were both going to fly back to the U.S., and I was really feeling like there were so many pastries that I hadn't eaten yet, and I had to eat as many as possible before I left.
With urgency and anxiety, like, I have to eat all of them.
As ridiculous as this story is of me wanting to eat all of the pastries in the city of Paris, it also represents a big part of what it's like to leave a place. You want to experience as much as possible before you leave, and no matter how hard you try, you'll still feel like you're missing something when you're in any other place. As impossible as I know it is to define the best, worst, and hardest parts of anything, I still ask Lindsay what the hardest part of so-called reverse culture shock was in her move back to the United States.
Most of it was linguistic. I got used to expecting every time I heard English for it to be intended for me, or at least somebody I knew. It was always very, like, suddenly familiar. And then walking around the streets in Boston, which is where I landed and was staying for the first few days when I landed back in the States, it was just like everyone was familiar.
Even though Lindsay could define this as the biggest part of her adjustment home, I know I couldn't begin to choose a hardest element of this major transition. I don't have answers to any of the questions. What was France like? Do you speak French now? What was the best part? Do you miss it? Are you happy to be home? None of these questions have easy answers. The complexity of moving and living abroad and moving back home can't be summarized with good, bad, yes, no answers. Even the idea of reverse culture shock doesn't encapsulate the emotional and cultural challenges of moving home after creating a completely new life somewhere else. by no means does this challenge mean I wish I'd never moved to France. I would never do it any other way. The biggest challenge right now is trying to find a clear ending to the story, probably because I'm right in the middle of it. Cultural adjustment has no finish line, so for now, I'm just signing off. From Real College Podcast, I'm Elizabeth Yost.
Vinyl is the newest hipster trend, but it's also really expensive. In recent years, cassettes have risen in popularity as the cheaper alternative for the quirky hipster among us. Audrey Kennedy tells us her story about how she became swept up and fell in love with cassettes.
My parents bought my first car without telling me. My grandma wanted a new one, so they decided to buy hers at a ridiculously cheap price, and they had it shipped up here so that they could declare I now owed them half the price they paid for a car I hadn't ever seen before. The car was what I considered to be old, aka from 2004. It ran great, but the one thing that bothered me was that it didn't have any Bluetooth connections or a spot to plug an aux cord into so I could play music. And yes, you heard me right, this car had a cassette player, and that was it. There was always radio, but it was never anything that wasn't ad-filled with bad music. The aux cord thing my mom gave me was crap. It barely worked, so I was left to try and find actual cassette tapes. So I asked my mom, and she told me that she had plenty. She brought out one of apparently multiple shoeboxes, and I could hear the excitement in her voice as she found that one Prince cassette she bought in ninth grade, and in the way she preached the amazingness of Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen. When I told my friends that if I drove them around, we were going to have to listen to Neil Diamond, they thought I was kidding. For a year and a half, every time I opened my glove box, I was presented with about 12 to 15 cassette tapes, with genres ranging from classic rock to the Dirty Dancing soundtrack. Every time I would pick up my little brothers from a friend's house, I would blare my Everybody Dance Now cassette as loud as I could. You know, like that terrible but also amazing song from the 80s? But eventually, I got a working aux cord, albeit after a year. And I didn't really get into cassettes until I almost crashed my car. I was driving to Plymouth when I realized my wheels were making a clunking noise every time they rotated, and by the time I made it onto the highway, I didn't have any control over the steering wheel. I started smelling smoke and called my mom, freaking out. Somehow, I made it to a mechanic, and after they took a look at my car, they told my dad they couldn't believe I even made it a mile, much less to their mechanic shop. I bought a new car. It has some fancy Bluetooth thing I'm still confused by. I ended up getting my new car on my mom's birthday. I lamented all of my lost tapes to my mother. After all, she owned most of them. I filled up a shoebox with all the things that reminded me of my car. 3 broken aux cords, 20 old cassettes, Bruce Springsteen, weird movie soundtracks, Christmas music. I put the box in my closet until a week later when I walked into my room to find a beat-up Optimus cassette player on my desk with a note that said, "Bought it at a garage sale. I couldn't let you lose all those great 80s memories." That night, I listened to my one current cassette tape, Thank Your Lucky Stars by Beach House, and I realized that once I wasn't forced to use it, the sound is actually freaking great. It makes me feel like I'm in some old movie dancing around my room to staticky sounding tapes. I had to get more, and preferably not 80s music. I found my first tape at Urban Outfitters for way too much money, so I ended up buying a 5-pack of Maxwell tapes from Amazon for $7 and recorded my own. I got another cassette player just to record on, and when I went to Target and asked where to find it, the guy looked at me like I was the first person to ever ask. From there, I recorded my first real mixtape. When I told my mom that all I had to do was plug in my phone running a playlist and hit record, she lamented that we modern kids had it so easy. I buy cassettes that just look cool, or ones that I can't find anywhere else, not even on Spotify. I once spent 3 hours at Cheapo Records going through every single tape on their giant 15 shelves wide wall, and I ended up leaving with a Blues Brothers tape, 2 Frank Sinatra albums, and the Close Encounters soundtrack. I went looking for newer music at a place called Dead Media and found a host of local bands all selling albums for under $5, and I currently have a Scooby-Doo cassette tape my longtime best friend sent me with a post-it note that says, "To listen to at college when you solve all your mysteries, like why the heck we're still friends after all these years." I didn't even bring a speaker to college. Unless I want to blast it through a terrible iPhone speaker, any music I want to listen to, I have to record on blank tapes. I've got about 15 mixtapes, like actual mixtapes, that I decorated with cool paper and stickers. And they all have angsty names like Gloom and Doom and Songs I Can't Sing, which is all 1960s Italian music. When I mention I love cassettes, people always ask me why. My go-to answer is that I want to be hipster. Cassette tapes are 25 cents and more difficult to find, which makes the hunt more fun. It's the same reason I like thrift shopping. It's cheap and you find weirder stuff. Plus, it sounds way cooler than some fancy Bluetooth speaker, in my opinion. But to get more emotional, I found I have a minor attachment to every cassette I own, mostly because of the people who gave them to me. And if nothing else, having 40-plus cassette tapes in my room makes for a great fun fact for all those awkward freshman icebreakers.
Lou Blank is a freshman here at the University of Minnesota. And after living here for just a month, he's realized that what you're told about college as a high school senior is very different from what actually affects your college experience. Lou Blank tells more.
Back in my senior year of high school, I had this friend who, totally out of the blue, would just drive an hour and a half out east to the city of Waukesha, Wisconsin, for literally no reason. Like, it would be 4 p.m., class would have just let out, and he'd just drive out east 80 miles, go to this coffee shop he liked for an hour or two, and then drive back home for dinner. And he did this like two or three times a week. This, of course, became the laughing stock of me and my friends. You know, we teased him so much about this weird obsession that we actually ended up going there ourselves one Saturday, just to walk around the city, visit that coffee shop, and see what made Waukesha so great. Of course, there was nothing really there. I think my friend just had this strange obsession. But when we sat down at that coffee shop in Waukesha, something very peculiar happened. There was this awkward silence. You know, the one where everybody looks at each other trying to determine who will speak next. And suddenly, for no apparent reason, the four of us all started talking about college applications. It was like we all internally had to get this monkey of college apps off of our backs, and we all knew it. Our conversation lasted for over an hour, a tense period of venting about which colleges we applied to, how important it was for us to get into our dream schools, how much anticipation and anxiety we had waiting to hear back from the admissions office. It was like a positive feedback loop of stress. The stress over which college you go to had a lot of really bad effects on my friends. You know, they would work so hard, stress so much, care so deeply about their college apps that they felt like they somehow had to justify all the hard work by going to an expensive elite school. Their line of thinking was, I've worked so hard to get good grades in high school. I've invested so much time into marketing myself to the college of my dreams. It has to culminate in something perfect, right? I saw this belief cause my friends to experience immense amounts of stress, disappointment, and even depression. It's also the exact atmosphere, the exact culture that nudged many of my friends in the direction of dishing out ungodly sums of money to private universities. The irony, of course, is that this will lead to even more stress, as my friends' decisions to go to more expensive schools will leave them with the burden of paralyzing student debt once they do graduate. But my friend JJ has a different outlook on college apps. I spoke with JJ the other day about what he thought about spending hundreds of thousands of additional dollars to go to an expensive, prestigious school. And what he told me was that there are actually advantages to not going to such a school. And regardless of where you end up going, you shouldn't subject yourself to that level of mental and fiscal stress.
I could go to Harvard, but if I stay in my room and I'm studying all the time because I'm barely passing my classes, and I end up barely passing my classes and I have like a C average because everyone else is a genius, so so many people are, like, the tests are so hard that I'm average at the school, so I'm getting C's, then I have no confidence, and I'm also not going out and experiencing new things. It just doesn't seem worth it to me.
And also, the factor of being in debt, you know, having to fork over way more money, right?
Yeah, it's crushing. Like, being in debt is mentally not a place you ever want to be.
And yet, so many high school seniors don't see it that way. There was a genuine atmosphere of extreme stress over college decisions in my school. And from my experience, it was largely reinforced by who we were surrounded by. You know, throughout all of my high school senior year, I was almost entirely surrounded by people urging me to take college applications even more seriously than I already was. And when my friends and I talked about college, we fed off of each other's stress, reinforcing our worries. And of course, any conversation with our parents or high school counselors was plagued by high expectations, which also added to our stress. Basically, everyone we talked to amped up our level of college anxiety. But who didn't we hear from during our senior year? Which opinions were we missing out on? Well, we never heard what the actual experience is actually like from the other side. We never really thought about how actual college freshmen who have been through this experience and came out on the other end view this problem. And what these college students will tell you, myself and my friend JJ included, is that where you go is nowhere near as important as what you do with your time once you get there. You know, on a day-to-day basis, what matters the most is the living experience, not the status or the prestige. You know, when I get up in the morning here at the U, I think about the beautiful city I live in, the wonderful friends I'm going to meet up with, and the cool classes and organizations that I'm a part of. I don't ever think about how selective my school is, if it's prestigious enough, or if the admissions rate is aligned with my ACT scores. You know, those are the things you're told to worry about all throughout senior year. But when you actually get to college, it's honestly the last thing on your mind. And it's critically important that our next generation of high school seniors understands that. I honestly believe that if me and my friends had spent more time talking to actual college freshmen, we would have focused less on the status of the college and more on the actual experience of living on campus. Because, put quite frankly, that's what will actually affect your daily life. I think we desperately need to reframe the message about college that we're sending to our next generation. That what's important about college is not so much the selectivity of where you go, but what you make out of the experience once you get there.
That's all for this week's episode of Real College Podcast. Huge thanks to our amazing group of new reporters for taking on the task of telling us about their lives. I really appreciate it. Thank you all so much for listening. You can hear all of our episodes at radiok.org/Real College Podcast. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes. RCP is a production of Radio K. It's produced by yours truly, Emily and Liv. Jaka is our host and managing editor. Thanks to her for showing me how to make the episode. Thanks for listening and tune in every Monday at 6:30 p.m. for arts and culture coverage, and come back next week to hear some more personal essays. Thanks.